On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we dig into the Toronto Blue Jays. Remember them? They went to Game 7 of the World Series last year, but right now they're under 500, very injured, and yet still in a playoff spot. We welcome in Shai Davidi of Sportsnet, joining me with Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet, pinch co-hosting for Jake Mintz still in Italy. Then we talk about some more sweeps. We talk about the Mets getting back on track. We talk about the Chicago White Sox. Oh my goodness, what a start to the season for them. And a little bit more before we say goodbye. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world seeking justice for Chad Dallas. I'm Jordan Schusterman. That is not Jake Mintz, as Jake Mintz is still in Italy. But don't worry, friends. We still have some international flavor. It's Ben Nicholson-Smith of Canada. Ben, hi. How are you?
Jordan, that's a great intro. Happy to add some international flavor to the show. Great to talk baseball with you, as always.
Ben, you have been asked to pinch hit for Jake Mintz. Not the first time, so you're ready. This is not someone where it's like, you know, they bring in a pitcher, they're like, this guy hasn't pinch hit in 3 years. What are they thinking? No. We know what we're getting from Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet, formerly of MLB Trade Rumors, and most importantly, of Canada. Ben, your colleague, Shai Davidi, also of Sportsnet, is going to join us later on in the show to talk about the Toronto Blue Jays. But you, I know this for sure, you do know ball beyond the Blue Jays. And that is why you are here to host with me on this Monday edition of Baseball Barbacast.
Well, we'll let the listeners decide whether I know ball. But I know that I love talking baseball. And honestly, we're at the point in the season where it's like, it's getting very interesting because you have some trends that are like, okay, this is not just a tiny sample anymore. There's a lot going on. The playoff picture is starting to take shape. So I feel like it's a fun time of year to step in and try to, you know, at least provide a quality AB in the absence of Jake Mintz.
And hey, it's June. I mean, we can't, you know, when it's April, you say it's April. When it's May, you can say, well, it's just May. You can't, can you say it's just June? It just doesn't really...
No.
Isn't really, you know, you really can't, yeah. Right? You really can't do
that's
that.
When it, because you would never say it's just July. It's just August. No, I think May is the last point you can say that.
All right. Well, we have a lot to get to, of course, as we always do on Mondays. And we are going to begin in against all odds. If you told us, hey, you're going to have Ben Nicholson-Smith co-host for Jake on June 1st, and who are you going to talk about first? Our opener, folks, is the Chicago White Sox. Well, 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 look at these boys go. The Chicago White Sox gave us one of five sweeps from the weekend, but they are the one we are going to talk about first because they took all three games from the Detroit Tigers, sending the Detroit disaster to even more unthinkable depths. We are going to talk about the Tigers and where the hell they go from here. But let's keep it positive. Let's have some good vibes here on Monday morning and talk about the Chicago White Sox, who have won their 32nd game of the season before June. For those of you keeping track of the Chicago White Sox, a team who famously 2 years ago was one of the worst baseball teams in the history of baseball, they won their 32nd game on September 4th, Ben. That was when they got win number 32 2 years ago. But now here they are, in a postseason spot ahead of the Toronto Blue Jays, who we will talk about later, and within striking distance at the top of the American League Central. As you've observed the White Sox this season, what has struck you as particularly impressive, particularly competent, or maybe particularly surprising?
So, of course, it's the power, and I know Murakami now on the injured list, so far from ideal from that standpoint. But even to have Colson Montgomery and Vargas doing what they're doing, I just feel like there's a bit more pop to this lineup than what we've seen in recent years. I love the Grant Taylor relief experiment, and they're using him in these different ways. We've seen him get saves. We've seen him open games. I feel like he's a difference maker. You know, looking at the rest of their pitching staff, I do wonder what's going to happen. I'm not sure if they have what it takes, if they have the horses, so to speak, to sustain this. But hey, I mean, they're at this point in the season, at a time that you have three wildcard berths available, they're in it. And so I'm fascinated to see where they go.
They swept the Tigers without getting a starting pitcher. That's Davis Martin, who is leading MLB with 8 pitcher wins, or at least tied for the lead. I know Aaron Ashby's he's got like 9 in relief for Milwaukee, which is one of the goofier stats of the early season. But Davis Martin, 8-1, 2.00 ERA in 67 innings. He's got more than a strikeout per inning. And he didn't even pitch this weekend against Detroit. But I do agree with you. There are parts of this pitching staff that you look at and you say, I don't know how much well this is going to hold up. You mentioned Grant Taylor. I'm also a fan of him. The guy they paid to be their closer, you are familiar with, that's Sir Anthony Dominguez. I know he's someone that has not exactly been the most reliable ninth inning guy so far this season. He's someone that Red Sox fans are maybe not enjoying quite as much. But hey, he pitched a couple scoreless innings against the Tigers. That said, most pitchers are throwing scoreless innings against the Tigers recently. So I don't know how much credit we're going to give to Sir Anthony there. But yeah, what else with the White Sox? I mean, this is one hell of a turnaround. Sure, last year they were not one of the worst teams of all time. They were still very bad. They did lose 100 games last year. Who should we be looking towards and being and giving them their – is it Will Venable? Is it Chris Getz? Like, who should we be talking about?
I think ultimately it's the players. I think that Venable and Getz, yeah, they're off to good starts. Here we are at this point in the season. They're making things interesting. And my big question is, what's going to happen in the next 2 months? Because if the White Sox continue to play at or around 500, I mean, they probably should be going for it. They probably should be adding, even if they're quote unquote ahead of schedule. And I think, you know, you could contrast this with a team like the Orioles, which seem to like sit on their prospects, sit on, you know, making that big move for a long time. And obviously they've been more aggressive in the last 12 months or so. But every time you have a chance to make things interesting and potentially make a push for the postseason, I think there's a case to be made for that. Now, we're a long way from the trade deadline still. And so they would need continued health. They would need continued results from the Davis Martins and the Colson Montgomerys of the world. But who knows? I mean, I think there's a scenario where they are buyers in this coming summer.
I think that's a good transition back to Murakami, because Murakami, who's on this 2-year, $34 million, $36 million deal, that of course is one of the biggest stories of the season, is him just having this incredible start to his career and everyone wondering, what were they thinking? How did no one give this guy a bigger deal? How does he end up on the White Sox? And remember, when he's homering every other day at the beginning of April and the White Sox still look pretty bad, people are already trying to get him traded and say, well, he's not staying long term. Let's just trade this. Like, think about what they could get for him if people try to come after and make offers for him, which would be a really goofy sequence. Well, now that's certainly not the conversation we're having, partially because the White Sox are better and partially because now Murakami is injured, which is unfortunate. That is a pretty big deal when you consider how much he's contributed to this lineup to begin the season. They've called up Jacob Gonzalez, who's a former first-round pick of theirs. Very strange prospect trajectory with him. He was a first-round pick shortstop out of Ole Miss, who it looked like he checked every box statistically of what you would want. 3 years of performing in the SEC, he's a good shortstop. Hell yeah, Jacob Gonzalez. And then kind of just fell on his face for his first couple of seasons in pro ball. Totally revived his career the last couple of years, and now he gets a shot weirdly playing first base because Murakami's out. So this is a shortstop playing first base, which is a bit of an odd dynamic, but he's at least going to get an opportunity here on offense. Montgomery, though, is the big one, and Vargas in particular. I mean, these guys, Montgomery's one thing. He was a top prospect, and we saw glimmers of it last year. For Vargas, who is also, I don't know if you've seen the memes about it, or if you remember that picture of him 2 years ago after he got traded there initially, of him sitting, it was in Oakland. I remember this so vividly. At some point at the second half of 2024, they just showed Miguel Vargas sitting in the dugout, just looking like, oh my God. Remember, he's traded from the Dodgers, so he's thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be on the Dodgers. This is great. It's like, no, just kidding. Now you're on the worst team of all time. And I just remember and he wasn't good, right? So he also was performing poorly. So you're just like, wow, this is just this sad baseball story. And now the guy's hitting walk-off homers. The guy's, look at his Savant page. Oh my goodness. Like, this is a legit hitter that has turned into someone. And he was also a prospect of some promise. But the Vargas, looking at the guys who were there, because there's not that, that's the craziest part. Not that many guys on this team were playing regularly even 2 years ago, and that's probably not an accident.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's going to be so fascinating. Like, you look at someone like Anthony Kay, right, who comes back over, and there is a parallel here to the Nationals, who I know we're going to get to in a second. As far as bringing players from overseas, oh, it hits. Okay, Anthony Kay now is pretty locked in. He's giving them quality innings. This is what they're going to need, clearly, to contend, is to have some sort of stability where they're not making things up on the fly too often. Pair that with a decent offense, play in a weak division. I mean, you never know. I'm pretty intrigued to see which direction things go. And I think ultimately, like, we still have to return to our prior assumptions about this team and keep in mind that going into this season, nobody really expected them to be a contender. So I'm going to keep that in mind. I'm probably going to expect that they turn into a team that's likely listening on Anthony Kay and Sir Anthony Dominguez at the trade deadline. But in the meantime, they have a couple months to prove that wrong and to flip that assumption and to make this thing really interesting.
And, like, they might be in position to do kind of, or do a situation where even if you trade some of those veteran guys, you don't even get that much worse. Like, most of your core guys are in place, are younger. We'll see what depth they have in AAA to backfill some of that. And some of those guys that we've seen have been promising. Some of them have been injured and inconsistent. Now we see David Sandlin. Noah Schultz came up, but he got hurt. Do we see Hagen Smith at some point? There's Braden Montgomery. Do we see him at some point? Because the outfield has been still a pretty big weakness for much of this season. A little bit better with Antonacci there, and Randall Grichuk has been shockingly productive. So it's just cool to see. I mean, for what these fans went through the last few years, it's just unbelievable to see where they're how much they're enjoying it, and seeing how lively that atmosphere was in a ballpark that was as morose as could possibly be not that long ago.
I'm glad you mentioned Antonacci too, because I feel like him, along with Montgomery, along with Vargas, along with Murakami, you know, potentially Gonzalez, like, this is where you start to get the makings of, like, an actually good lineup. Doing it for 2 months is different than doing it for six, but there's some actual offensive talent here that's not just flash in the pan BABIP or old guy having a couple good months. Like, there's some real ability here.
Yeah. And sixth in OPS, fourth in homers, seventh in total runs. Like, this was one of the most brutal lineups you could possibly tune in for not long ago. And now it's like, oh yeah, I'll watch the White Sox. A little bit less so without Murakami. That is definitely a big bummer. But it's just cool to see. And there are definitely parts of this roster that I am very much enjoying. On the other side of this weekend was whatever is going on with the Detroit Tigers. This is the classic case of, surely it can't get any worse. No, there's no way that it can be worse than these losses to the Angels, or, you know, some of these home defeats and just miserable homestands. And then you go into Chicago and the White Sox just seize on what is just a complete collapse, mostly from the offense. I know we can mention the fact they are 4-21 since Tarek Skubal went down. And that's a fact. You can't ignore that split. But that's not, as we know, Tarek Skubal was only going to pitch every so often. But that news, just combined with every possible version of regression and some other key hitters that are missing, like a Kerry Carpenter, like a Gleyber Torres, of course, Javier Baez, even to a degree. But even if you plug those guys in, it's not like they were playing a great ball before then. And now they have the worst record in baseball, Ben. They have the worst record in baseball. And I think with them, like, we can dig into the specifics, but at some point we're just having a large conversation about the obvious, which is, like, where their playoff odds have now dipped into single digits. And some of you could say, well, duh, they have the worst record in baseball. But in the American League, they're still only, I think, 7 games back of the third wild card. What is the number where you are having real Skubal conversations? If he comes back in a few weeks and they're still in last place all the way back, does, you know, Pobo Scott Harris have the guts to do something like that? Would fans understand it in this case? You know, like, that's the other part. They would still be mad because of the state of the team, but would a Skubal trade go across as almost less insulting under these circumstances? It's still a disaster, but I'm curious your take on the Skubal timeline and the likelihood we see him moved.
Yeah, and it's wild that we're even having that conversation here on June 1st. I mean, this is, maybe you think, okay, you'll play it out until the end of July, the beginning of August, and then at that point, there's a very difficult decision to be made. For their playoff odds to have dropped this far so early in the season in that division, I mean, it just reflects how poorly things have gone for the Tigers, and incredibly disappointing because they had reason to believe they would definitely have the pitching and even have the makings of a solid offense, a good bullpen that AJ Hinch can manage well. Then you look at the way some of these things have gone wrong for them. 0-5 in extra innings, 5-13 in one run games. So they're not performing well. They arguably don't have as good of an offense as they thought they would going into things. Obviously, the Skubal injury is massive. But then even with that, it's been unfortunate and frustrating. And just, you know, these losses, like you're mentioning, to the Guardians, where they should have won some of those games against Cleveland at home. They should have won some of these games against the White Sox, and they just couldn't get it done. Now, I don't think that that's necessarily reflective of some core inability on this team. Certainly, AJ Hinch knows his way through a one-run game. Like, he can do it. It's just, this has happened. So here they are, playoff odds not in a good spot. Overall direction of the franchise not in a great spot. And so, as for Skubal, I think you just got to read the hand in front of you, and you don't have to do it now, because ultimately, the Tigers, if they decide on August the 1st, and I think the deadline's the 3rd this year, but if they decide on August 1st, okay, we're out of it, they have 48 hours is enough. Teams are going to line up. Teams are going to wait. They're going to be willing to give up a ton for Tarik Skubal, presuming he's healthy. So at this point, you just play it out until then, because you're not going to trade him on July 13th. You're not going to even trade him on July 25th. So you just wait and see where you are.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's now the real conversation is, okay, this is so bad. Why is this going to get better? And that's the part where, sure, you could say something be this bad, especially on the mound. You can say, hey, Dylan Dingler, Riley Green, Kevin McGonigal, that's three homegrown guys that are playing real well. Like, that in theory would be a positive offensive trio to build around. And instead, it's just been a mess, even with those guys performing well. Obviously, Torkelson is a big part of that. Some of these guys that are injured have been a big part of that. So it's just really bleak. And while I totally agree with you that they're not trading Skubal in the next month, no matter what, it's just wild that we are even contemplating it to any possible degree.
It is. It really is. And this is where, you know, They've got to turn this around somehow, despite whatever's happened. I think they can get back into it. But if the playoff odds drop any further, I mean, that's gonna determine the fate.
Also, like, worst record in baseball now is not just a couple games under. I mean, there's 22-38.
They've barely won for like 2.5 weeks. And that includes so many painful losses. Like, the vibes aren't good. I don't know how it's got to turn pretty quick if they're going to get back into it.
When you mentioned AJ Hinch knows his way around a one-run game, and yes, historically that's been true. But like yesterday, when they were up 1-0, Cater Montero's dominating. I had a tweet like typed out, and then I was like, you know what? Whatever. I don't need to say anything here. But I was going to say, boy, do the Detroit Tigers really need to win this baseball game, and I don't think they will. Like 20 minutes later, Colson Montgomery homer, they take the lead, they lose again, and just like, oh my goodness.
And even on that one, because I understand it, and Tigers fans might hate me for this, and fair enough, but like Cater Montero, I know he hadn't allowed any runs, but it's not like he was Jacob Mizorowski or Chase Burns out there missing bats. Like, he had 6 whiffs in the entire game. And then they go to Drew Anderson, who's actually been pretty nasty. Like, no disrespect to Cater Montero, but like, he wasn't missing bats. So AJ Hinch, from my perspective, is just trying to make the move that is going to keep runs off the board the best. And it totally backfired, but I get the thinking behind the move.
Yeah, I mean, I'll push back just because he was still being efficient. I agree he wasn't missing bats, but the state of their bullpen, Drew Anderson had allowed a walk-off home run 2 days earlier. I know he's been good, and oh my God. Okay, enough Tigers. Let's get back to something positive. Yeah.
I know. Last thing on the Tigers. Score 2 runs, and we're not having this discussion. Score 3 runs, you know? Like, of course the magnifying glass is going to be on these things, but they're just not scoring. So, like, someone hit a 2-run double.
Way too many runs. You're getting way too greedy. Hey, you know who doesn't have any trouble scoring runs? How about that transition? the Washington Nationals. In fact, no one is scoring runs better than the Washington Nationals, who are 31 and 29. The Washington Nationals are 31 and 29, and I wanted to move them here into the A block as a kind of tandem vibe check with the Chicago White Sox, because while these teams are very different and got to this position in very different ways in terms of their on-field performance, in terms of their franchise trajectory, I do think that these teams were indirectly linked coming into the season, because when you looked at the preseason projections, whether you pulled up Fangraphs, you pulled up Pecota, you pulled up, even if you looked at the over-unders in Vegas and you said, okay, who are going to be the worst teams in baseball? Obviously, the Rockies coming off of last year were in a tier of their own at the bottom. And sorry, Rockies fans, it looks like you are maybe heading back towards that tier of your own at the bottom as well. I know you did win a series this weekend, so maybe the Giants will join you in that bottom tier. But the White Sox and Nationals were those next two teams. No matter what you look at, sure, maybe you saw the Angels in there and the Marlins were at the bottom. The Cardinals, for the super bearish projections, were going to have them down there. But generally, it was the White Sox and Nationals. And yet, as we mentioned, the White Sox were playing great. And the Nationals are over 500 and scoring so many runs. They are averaging 5.4 runs per game, which is best in baseball. I've hit 77 homers, which is sixth, and they are an absolute delight to watch when they are hitting. I know they are in the other league, but what do you think about the American League that you follow so closely? But how about these Nats, baby? I mean, this is something to behold.
It's fun. You always love to see teams just pop up and surprise. This is clearly ahead of schedule. James Wood, MVP caliber season. Oh. Clearly, that's real. CJ Abrams probably came into the season as the most obvious trade chip in baseball and might still be the most obvious trade chip in baseball, but is having a great season offensively. And then you get to, like, I mean, Joey Weimer and Curtis Meade leading the way as well. Like, I can't say that I expected that. Very cool that that's happening. I feel like Luis Garcia, there's a lot there. He started to heat up a little bit. I feel like there's some real offensive talent there that probably helps the Nationals sustain this offensively. But I would say, similar to the White Sox, love to see it, intrigued, and they still have some proving to do. But this is fun.
And, you know, in the National League, it's a lot harder to see the path to a surprise wild card berth in the way that it is in the current American League. So that is definitely what the Nats are up against. But yeah, I mean, you combine Abrams and Wood just being elite players with some of these surprise development stories. Curtis Meade much more recently. Joey Weimer was more of a few weeks and now is not really relevant anymore. But Curtis Meade has just been a good hitter in this lineup for several weeks now. And for the first part of the season, they were allowing so many runs that even though they were scoring a bunch, they weren't actually winning that consistently. But more recently, like, Zach Littell was just unbelievable for all of May, as awful as he was to start. Foster Griffin's regressed a little bit, but he's been solid. Cade Cavalli has definitely shown flashes. The bullpen is still a bit of a roller coaster ride for sure. But that said, I mean, it's kind of like the White Sox. They're still part of the roster that are what we expected, and like, that's, you can't really blame them because they weren't planning on being in this competitive mode. But the Nationals have just been great to watch, and I think with them even more so than the White Sox, such an overhaul in terms of the coaching, in terms of the infrastructure. The White Sox haven't actually changed that much. I mean, credit to Will Venable and Getz and whatever, a lot of the same pieces are in place there, and the players, credit to the players. The Nats, it's just a completely different DNA that's kind of leading the charge, both at the front office and the coaching level. And you can see the difference that makes with young players, and you got to give them credit for that.
And that's got to be a good thing for the organization to even experience a bit of success, even if it's not sustained for the entirety of the season. To have that momentum, to have that pressure, is probably a good thing developmentally for both these teams. Now, from your standpoint, Jordan, looking at these two ball clubs, which one do you think is most likely to sustain this, say, through July and kind of enter the trade deadline in a position where they're like, hey, maybe we should actually go for this thing?
I kind of think the White Sox are more... So in terms of like the quality of the team, I guess I lean slightly towards the Nats. In terms of the front office and the process, I mean, that's another interesting part of this is you think about the fan base and you think about the front office and you think about almost the urgency, the desire to push forward in an aggressive way and trade away prospects. I think the White Sox are more likely to do that than the Nationals, considering the front office is in place. But you could argue it in the other direction, and you could say, actually, the Nationals have been worse for longer, which is true. You could say, hey, hello, you take advantage of this opportunity that your team's better. You have actually a decent team. Don't trade CJ Abrams. Go get some pitching help. You've got this rejuvenated farm system. You have pieces to deal. I don't think their playoff odds are likely to survive high enough at a point where that is going to be prudent for Paul Toboni, which is kind of a bummer because I think that it might kind of put a bit of a damper on this enjoyable summer if they do trade Foster Griffin. Like that's going to be a tough conversation and one that I imagine, let alone CJ Abrams. But even if you talk about trading a guy like Foster Griffin, who's been their most reliable starter, that would be pretty deflating for the clubhouse, I can imagine. And I don't know. I mean, those are tough calls for Toboni, but future is pretty bright for both of these teams, I think. And that alone, you have to give them credit for.
And look, maybe even if they are sellers in the end, well, maybe they're trying to acquire players that are a little closer to the major leagues, knowing that, hey, mm-hmm. some of these young major leaguers yeah. are contributing, are ready to win in, if not 2026, 2027, 28. So sure. you don't necessarily need that 17-year-old DSL prospect. Maybe you're looking for someone who's a double A and who's going to be on a 40-man roster pretty soon.
But sometimes those 17-year-old DSL prospects are Fernando Tatis Jr., who homered for the first time this weekend. How about that transition? I was not ready for that one.
That was actually very smooth, Jordan. I didn't want to interrupt. That was nice.
Honestly, I don't have that much more to say about the Padres this weekend. They are very weird. They lost the series to the Nationals and are starting to show cracks of like, oh, you aren't keeping up with the Dodgers. This is not happening for you. But hey, Tatis homering for the first time. Maybe he's about to go on a crazy heater and just carries their offense for a few weeks.
What astounds me most about the Padres, I mean, aside from the Tatis, you know, homerless stretch that recently ended, what astounds me most is you lose Dylan Cease and Nick Pivetta and somehow your pitching is still incredible. Like, that's impressive. Obviously, kudos to Randy Vasquez and Walker Buehler and everyone else who's doing their thing in San Diego, because that's probably not how a lot of people would have projected it.
For sure. And Vasquez has been good. I mean, the rest of the pitching, and we'll see how our pal Lucas Giolito continues to settle into their rotation. It's just the bullpen. I mean, the bullpen is carrying them to a degree that was kind of the plan all along. But what they're getting from King and Vasquez has definitely been solid. Okay, one more series before we bring in Shai Davidi. We got another sweep to talk about. Let's talk about the New York Mets, baby. Are they back? Probably not, but they're 26-33. They're out of last place by sweeping the Marlins. They are no longer in last place as they have been for several weeks. Sorry to the Fightin' Fish, who now occupy the basement. Some good things happened in Queens. We got MJ Melendez walk-off home run. We got Christian Scott looking like a real rotation piece. Juan Soto, if you're familiar with his game, is quite a good hitter. His WRC plus is up to 175, which is ridiculously good. And exactly what you would expect from one of the greatest hitters of all time, which is what he is. However, the Mets are not going to play the Marlins again anytime soon. And while it is nice to kind of gather some momentum towards a much tougher part of your schedule, we're going to find out if they actually have their stuff together or not here, because their schedule coming up at Mariners, at Padres, Cardinals, Braves, at Reds, at Phillies, Cubs, Phillies. So they're really only playing teams above 500 for the next month plus, and we will see how that works out for them. However, the one Mets thing I want to make sure we touch on, because you're quite familiar with this topic, is Bo Bichette. Because Bo Bichette, Ben, has not really been very good at baseball this season. He is currently still playing, I guess he's playing shortstop because Francisco Lindor is out. So that was not really part of the plan. But more importantly, whatever he's playing, he actually looked okay at third. At least he was grading out okay at third. the bigger issue is that Bo Bichette has a 67 OPS plus, which for someone making a whole lot of money, actually, you know what? If for someone making league minimum, that is not good enough. So we always say, well, wow, look what he's getting. Yes, that is a very relevant part. Let's move the contract to the side for now and talk about the fact that he has not been good. I don't know how much, Bo, you've watched this season, but just kind of big picture thoughts about the move to begin with and then how this has gone so far.
Yeah, of course, had the chance to watch some Bo Bichette. My algorithm feeds me a lot of Bo Bichette defensive highlights, or I should say defensive plays. I see that on my For You page a lot. I watch every single one, which is probably why my algorithm keeps feeding it to me. So yep. As for the offense, look, we've seen so much of Bo Bichette in the course of his young but extensive major league career to know that he's a really good hitter. And even in the midst of these struggles where he has had such a bad 2 months, you look at the XBA on Baseball Savant, it's 279, which is quite good. So at minimum, he's not striking out a ton. He's putting the bat on the ball. These are all Bo Bichette things. He continues to do that. And so, yeah, it's been awful, clearly well below what he's capable of, well below what we would expect. Now, flip it forward. What do we expect from Bo Bichette now? I have a hard time anticipating that he's going to be anything other than an above average hitter, especially with the batting average, but even with the power. I know he only has 5 home runs so far this season, but he's such a good hitter that to me, his floor moving forward is like one of those late career Justin Turner seasons where it's like high batting average, 800 OPS, hit you a few home runs. You know, he's not necessarily a burner on the bases, but he can play you some defense. Like, that to me is the floor. And the ceiling, obviously, is impact hitter. Hits, you know, 15 home runs between now and the end of the season. OPS more like 840, 850. That's all in Bo Bichette's bag. So we'll see if he can get there. But I've seen way too much of Bo Bichette not to believe that he is going to be a very good hitter.
I agree with that. I agree with that, but I just, this is where the contract and just the role in the team becomes more relevant, because when you've got these other guys out, like, this is when you need him to be a lot better than vintage Justin Turner. And while I agree with that scouting report, and I do generally believe he's going to hit his way back to something closer to league average, I mean, it's just been tough. And maybe when the other guys get healthy and he has a little bit more line of protection and he kind of fits in more, it'll start to come. If they play their way back into big games, he can give you the big swing, as we saw last postseason. I'm still a big fan of this guy, but it's just not been good enough so far. So, and it's part of the reason why they're in the hole that they're in. I mean, he has the most plate appearances on the team by a lot, and he's been one of the worst hitters in the league. So whatever we project moving forward, he has contributed, unfortunately, in a pretty negative way. That said, Mets, you won a series. You swept a series. Good for you. You're not in last place anymore. You're no longer the last place Mets with $400 million payroll. You are the 26-33 Mets who have won 4 in a row and are now heading west to play Seattle and San Diego. So those don't look like series where the offense is about to explode, but maybe they will prove me wrong there.
Well, I just continue to think there's more here with the Mets, which is hardly a bold take. But just as the Nationals and White Sox might have had their best 2 months of the season, and I say might have, I hope I'm wrong. I hope that this is the beginning of like a Nationals and White Sox, you know, dream season for the ages. But let's acknowledge that's possible. And it's also possible this is the worst 2 months of the Mets season. And I think too, like Nolan McLain, when I started to get a little worried about the Mets was when Nolan McLain started to like have these horrible outings, like 2 times out of 3. Yep. But he bounced back a little bit, only 5 innings against the Marlins this weekend. Bounced back a little bit, and I think ended up getting the win in that one. So, you know, it's going to take a while to turn this around, but I do see promise here.
Yeah. And 26-33 is it somehow looks so much better than 22-38, which is where the Tigers are. So,
yeah.
All right, let's take a break. When we return, Shai Davidi will join us to talk some Jays. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jordan Schusterman, Ben Nicholson-Smith. And now we are joined by a good friend of the show and a colleague of Ben Nicholson-Smith. It is Shai Davidi. Shai, welcome to Baseball Barbacast.
This is a pleasure. And it's very fun to have Canadians outnumbering the Americans on the show now.
Hey, I think you guys earned this last season as the Blue Jays exploded into relevance all the way to Game 7 of the World Series, and I got to spend so much time with Ben and Shai in Toronto. And then I believe it was at the winter meetings where it was like right before I was leaving, we were all just hanging out, and we were like, this should be a podcast at some point. Now, I'll be honest, yes. I think at that point, Shai, we were like, well, the Jays clearly are going to be one of the best teams in baseball. There will be no shortage of opportunities to bring both of you on to talk Jays baseball. However, as we sit here on June 1st, the Blue Jays are under 500, very injured and very weird. So, Shai, I'll start with you because obviously we had to get a real Blue Jays expert opinion. Ben just, I mean, he's doing his best, but we'll come back to him at some point. Yeah, exactly. Ben understands who's, you know, seniority here. But Shai, like, what a weird year this has been. And I guess my big picture question about the Blue Jays are, has this been a disappointment, or are the injuries explaining a lot of these struggles, maybe more than some other teams?
I wonder if we can just say they're both things at the same time, right? Because you can look at the Blue Jays and say, okay, if, say, George Springer and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. were to this point having a normal kind of year for them, they probably have 3-4 more wins perhaps at this point, because a lot of their games have been that close. But at the same time, when you look at the degree of injuries that they've had and the caliber of player that they're missing, there was a point in time that a third of their batting order, now a third of the rotation or two-thirds of the rotation is missing. They've just been moving different pieces in and out. They've really had to make up so many things on the fly. You know, you could very easily see this team be 10 games under 500 and be like, okay, well, I can see how they got there. So the fact that they haven't let it slip that far, I think, is a credit to them, a credit to their pitching staff especially, but also to just the some of the culture that they've built up over the past couple of years. And it really is playing in an important way, the way they've been integrating various players, having them participate and contribute and succeed, and keeping this thing afloat until they can get to a situation where they're more the complete version of themselves.
And that's what's interesting. You see sort of these glimmers of like Blue Jays-ness, right? Like Brandon Valenzuela comes up and is immediately, you know, doing at least okay. You have some of these pitchers that have really started to step up, and I definitely want to talk about the state of the bullpen, but, you know, keeping it a little bit more big picture, just going back to you, Ben, we joked before we started recording about just, I experienced these conversations in the very lavish Blue Jays press box for much of last season. But when you guys as media members are talking about this team, I mean, how is the average Jays media member processing this? Like, is it almost just a, let's just hang on for dear life until everybody's healthy and then we can start evaluating this team? Or have there been points where you're looking at them and actually worried, Ben?
Well, I think the natural inclination is to try to start evaluating right away. And we're probably a little too hasty in doing that. But even in March, you're sitting there, okay, like they're you know, starting off so great, you know, against the A's in that opening series. And you think you've got it made sense of. And then every couple of weeks, you think that you have, you know, a new read on the team. So I think that's the nature of baseball fandom. Certainly, that's the nature of baseball coverage, where it's like, You think that what you're seeing in front of you is significant. And usually there's some significance to it, but you also have to strip away the noise and remember that it's a super long season. So I think as we look at the team right now, they're in an okay spot. I mean, for everything that's gone wrong, they still are in a position where they can take advantage of this season, led by some really good pitching. Like, Cease, Gausman, Yesavage could be enough to make this team relevant, even if Springer and Vlad are not having the seasons that we all expected that they would. So they still have a shot to be a relevant team, still have a shot to be in the playoffs when this thing is wrapping up toward the end of September.
The other thing that feels almost disorienting, and I'm really curious for you guys as to how you've dealt with this, have there been points during the season, and certainly injuries have contributed heavily, but again, we're barely into June, it's June 1st, have there been points during the season where you've looked up and you've watched the team and you've been like, oh my God, this is so different than the team that we just watched go to Game 7 of the World Series? Some of that is purposeful acquisitions and swaps and additions. Some of it is trades. Some of it is just injuries, guys having to come up and fill in. Shai, I'm curious how you can't talk about this like this is the same team. Every time I go and say, oh, well, Jay, this is the Jays. They were in Game 7 of the World Series. And then I look at who's in the lineup and who's pitching. I'm like, these guys weren't here. Like, what has that been like learning this new team?
Yeah, also a lot of guys who just are here who weren't supposed to be here, because at times, and Ben and I've joked, like, what's the roster move of the day today? And really, like, since Cody Ponce blew out his knee, they've just been in a constant state of churn, and they'd have these small pockets of stability where there isn't a roster move and the pitching staff can stay together or whatever it is. But they don't last long, because then there's another injury. So that's another set of arms, and it's another change in the rotation, and it's another spot that they're making it up. I mean, right now, they're carrying two bullpen days in the rotation. This, for a team that we spent a good chunk of the offseason debating, how are they going to deal with all the starting pitching surplus that they have? And it just reinforces that they have no surplus. This team, or there's no such thing as a pitching surplus. Like, they have just been really on that foot. So suddenly you're like, okay, well, Lenin Sosa is here and Austin Voth is here and Hayden Yeager is here. And all these guys who were either not in the organization, not part of the plan, and suddenly they're dependent. I mean, we've talked multiple times about how vital Patrick Corbin has been. Patrick Corbin did not have a job a week into the regular season. And so I think the degree of improvisation that this team has had to go through and still manage to stay afloat in spite of that, I think is really impressive.
Yeah, Ben, I mean, you can speak to that too. And you mentioned all the guys that are here. Chad Dallas, is he here or not, guys? What is going on? What is going on there? Sorry, we can circle back to that situation. I don't know if either of you were actually in Baltimore. I know Arden Zwelling, your colleague, gave us that fateful tweet that still has me confused and borderline angry. But you mentioned staying afloat, and I'll throw it back to you, Ben. Like, I say they're under 500. They are hilariously in a playoff spot right now, right? And that is more of a reflection of the American League than it is the Blue Jays. But I do think they deserve credit compared to some other teams who have let some injuries and misfortune spiral into just terrible play, whether that is Boston or Houston or obviously Detroit, Kansas City, and so on. So the Jays, they're still afloat here, but is there, maybe as we spin this forward, I mean, Ben, can you give us some update? Is there like an end in sight? Is there a person that needs to come back and is expected to come back soon where we can start to say, all right, we're starting to relax here? Cease feels like the obvious one. Kirk feels extremely important, but where are we at with those guys?
Yeah, Cease does feel like the big one, because running one bullpen game with a Rule 5 pick, I mean, that's already an uncomfortable place to be if you're a team trying to contend. Running two bullpen games, it's just flat out not sustainable. And so I think we ran into that in the course of the last week as the Blue Jays tried to run two bullpen games in a four-game series against the Orioles, end up splitting that series. And yeah, as they move forward, they need Cease back just to give them that baseline of pitching where it's Trey Savage, Kevin Gausman, Dylan Cease. Okay, now we have Patrick Corbin as the four. You figure out the five spot, you're good to go. I do think Alejandro Kirk also is just such a huge part of this team on both sides of the ball, except, I mean, Brandon Valenzuela has done an amazing Alejandro Kirk impression. Obviously different players, but when it comes to just stabilizing things behind the plate as a rookie that they acquired for Will Wagner last year, Valenzuela has done a phenomenal job. So in a weird way, they actually don't feel the absence of Kirk as much as they probably could have, considering he's one of their most valuable players and he's missed 2 months at this point.
Yeah, and I mean, listen, the list goes on and on. Barger still out. Santander is just totally off the map. Barrios, we know, had surgery. He's totally off the map. The two other pitchers, though, I do want to bring up in this conversation, because you just said with a straight face, well, now you have Patrick Corbin as your four and you're good to go. is Max Scherzer and Shane Bieber. Two main characters at the end of last season. Again, getting back to what I was saying, like there's so many main characters from last season who are just irrelevant or injured or not on the team anymore because they're Boba Fett. We'll talk about him with Ben. Is Scherzer and Bieber? I mean, Bieber, it sounds like he just had a rehab start. Are those guys that they are counting on, Shy, to be a part of this rotation at this point or anytime soon?
Yeah, I think what the Blue Jays are trying to do right now is just bridge to their return. And, you know, I do think it is, Ben mentioned Rule 5 pick, and that's Spencer Miles. It's not only that he's a Rule 5 pick. He's a Rule 5 pick that has pitched in 15 games professionally over the last 3 years because of injury. So not only is he inexperienced from a baseball standpoint, he's inexperienced from a workload standpoint and doesn't have a ton of volume. So the Blue Jays, every time he takes the ball and throws 70 pitches, that's kind of the range that he's in right now. And they're thinking about trying to push him to 80. This is uncharted territory for him. I think that's telling you just how tenuous some of what they're doing right now. So they're just trying to survive to the point that Scherzer comes in and he's closer right now as things stand than Shane Bieber is. He's probably got at least one more rehab start, but maybe 1 to 2, and then it's decision time on him. Shane Bieber is essentially at, if we were in spring training, he's at the beginning of March-ish, so he still needs a little bit more runway until he's going to be a factor. But, you know, he's, Scherzer is sort of like in the next, you know, maybe week to 10 days. And then Bieber is probably the latter part of this month. And then at that point, okay, well, the Blue Jays only have a little bit of pitching surplus again. And maybe at that point, it's Spencer Miles who's being put back into a bit more of a normal role. And they're not having to make up another rotation spot. And then the Blue Jays can start thinking about, okay, well, what do we have? How can we hold this together for the regular season? And then how can we address some of these things at the trade deadline?
Okay, I need to hammer home the absurdity of the Spencer Miles situation. And then I have one more pitching question for you, Ben. I want you both to hit on this when I come back to you. But let's just talk about Spencer Miles for a second, okay? You gave the stat there, Shy, and you actually were underselling it for a few reasons. So I believe you said 15 professional appearances over the last 3 seasons. It's really the last 4 seasons because he missed all of 2023. So he had 15 professional appearances in his career since being drafted in 2022 because of all of his injuries. That includes the Arizona Fall League, which like technically isn't even part of the regular season. He is up to now 16 appearances with the Toronto Blue Jays in the major leagues this season. Okay, like this is ridiculous. This, there's no way that this was plan A. And credit to Spencer Miles. I know it hasn't always been pretty. Like this weekend, it wasn't pretty. I mean, wow. Like whatever happens with him moving forward, I have to imagine he's gotten a lot of credit. And Ben, I mean, yeah, I don't know what how much you guys have been talking to Spencer Miles, but this just seems like an absurd story that is going kind of overlooked.
Yeah, no, absolutely it is. And I think too, like, okay, so he's obviously a rookie, you know, to the extreme when you talk about a Rule 5 pick with so little experience. Now, when you look at Treya Savage, who we think about as someone who's more established, well, he's also a rookie. And it was only very recently, like in the last few weeks, that his regular season innings total finally surpassed his playoff innings total for his career, because he pitched so much, of course, in the postseason in 2025. He was awesome, did a great job. So you have two rookies in the starting rotation. You have one other spot in the rotation that's basically, you know, completely up for grabs until someone like Scherzer or Shane Bieber comes back. Eric Lauer's been shipped over to the Dodgers, where he's actually kind of pitching well, by the way. And so,
of course, he is.
It's a tough spot to be in. Now, this is Major League Baseball. No one's crying for the Blue Jays. Other teams have solutions for this. Some teams have 6 starters and they're trying to, you know, appease them and figure it out. But ultimately, yeah, this is pretty slim when it comes to the margins for the pitching for the Jays.
Yeah.
And I will say,
Go ahead.
So I was going to mention this. Watching Spencer Miles handle all this, like, he does not look like a guy who has pitched as little as he has, right? He's just a really good demeanor. He's just really been steady through it. He like takes everything that he goes. He's obviously got a lot of confidence in himself. And, you know, of all, we've talked a lot about where would the Blue Jays be without Patrick Corbin, but we should also be saying, you know, where would the Blue Jays be without Spencer Miles, which just is all the more just wild when you think about what the Blue Jays situation was coming into spring training.
So the one other pitching conversation I definitely want to make sure that we have, and, you know, Gausman's having a fascinating season and Savage looks great. And Cease was really interesting kind of evolution since he joined Toronto with more ground balls, and he looks great and hopefully he's back soon. I think we have to pause and talk about this bullpen dynamic, specifically the Louis Varland super breakout combined with whatever the heck is going on with Jeff Hoffman. It seemed that pretty early on in the season, there was the first like, all right, Jeff Hoffman, we're going to take it easy with you. You're not going to be closing anymore. And, you know, we can afford to do that because we really trust Louis Varland. And since then, Louis Varland has ascended to, I mean, statistically, he's right there with Mason Miller, which for those of you who think that's impossible, go ahead and look. It's really not that different. In fact, I believe his ERA is lower than him at this point. So, Shai, like what, how is that working out? Because I've seen it work where Hoffman is still sometimes closing. There was a situation this weekend where Varland got the eighth and then Hoffman pitched after him and that didn't go very well. But we've also seen Varland, of course, record a bunch of saves. So what is the state of that? And how is the Louis Varland breakout being interpreted at this stage?
Well, I will tell you that there is obviously a lot of faith in Louis Varland, and obviously well-deserved. And the Blue Jays view him as the guy that they want in the highest of leverage spots. And there, you mentioned sort of Hoffman still getting some ninth innings. That there have been a few times where Varland has been on, just from a workload perspective, needed a day. So Hoffman has, or somebody else has ended up pitching the ninth. In the past week and a half or so, Trevor Rogers has also gotten a save. Brent Fisher has also gotten saves. So the Blue Jays bullpen has been used incredibly heavily. They've got five relievers who have appeared in 27 or more games at this point, which is a lot. So there have been times where they've had to move pieces around. But the way that the Blue Jays have approached this is that they basically are trying to identify what are the highest leverage points in the game. And what is the right pocket for a different reliever? And that is how they're slotting things in right now. So sometimes that means Louis Varland gets the ninth. Sometimes that means he might get the eighth, like he did on Saturday. And sometimes it does not work out the way that it did on Saturday. So the Blue Jays are trying to not box themselves into one thing, but trying to more match the reliever to the situation and to the leverage as well.
Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, it's so interesting because when you look at this team, of course, Louis Varland is their most trusted reliever. That has to be the way it is, given the way he's pitched and given the way Jeff Hoffman has pitched. And what happened on the weekend with Jeff Hoffman on Saturday, I mean, that was brutal, honestly. I mean, to come in, he allowed three consecutive hits, and then at that point, he allows two more walks before giving way to Connor Siebold, and the game falls out of hand. I mean, you hand the ball to an established relief pitcher of any description with a 4-run lead against a division rival, chance to take a series on the road. That's a game you just have to win. You just have to win that game, and it didn't happen. So massive frustration around Jeff Hoffman from the standpoint of Blue Jays fans at this point in time. Now, flip that to the clubhouse, flip that to the coaching staff. They still need Jeff Hoffman because he's still capable of missing bats. He's still capable as far as casting ahead of getting big outs for this team. And when you look at just the attrition of pitching in Major League Baseball, the challenge of getting through a long season, the fact that Jeff Hoffman is healthy and missing bats, from the standpoint of the coaching staff in the front office, of course, they need this guy. They need to get him on track. You can't get through 17 games in 17 days, which is what they just played, without relying on Jeff Hoffman. Because, you know, you look further down the bullpen, like, did you want to go to Hayden Yinger for his Major League debut? Did you want to go to Austin Voth, who, you know, was hit even harder? Like, at a certain point, you have to rely on the guys that are on your roster, and you can't play 17 and 17 without turning to some of these guys in big moments. So it just didn't work. But casting forward, they need Jeff Hoffman. They can't just DFA him the way some fans would love for that to happen.
I mean, Shai, you just mentioned a stat there earlier about how they have five guys that have appeared in 20 games. That's now 28 games after yesterday. Five different relievers who have appeared in at least 28 games. There are only 20 in the entire league that have appeared in 28 games, and the Jays have five of them, okay? So that is an absurd amount of usage early in a season. In fact, no other single team has more than two with at least 28 appearances. So, Ben, you mentioned, well, who are you going to go to, Hayden Younger? Or I'm looking at the Buffalo roster. Of course, I'd love to see Chad Dallas at some point, but they've got some Grant Rogers and C.J. Van Eyck and, you know, maybe we see Devereaux Harrison at some point. But the point is, you kind of do have to go to those other guys because you cannot burn these dudes. And then, by the way, this is coming after Louis Varland pitched in every postseason game, almost, right? So I'm impressed by it. But do you sense that there's an amount of, like, I know you're trying to say in this race and you want to win these divisional games. Is there going to be any sort of correction here, or does the correction come via the starting pitching gets healthier, and then we're not leaning on these guys for as many of these games early in the game as you think?
Ben. Yeah. I mean, I guess, like, what would the correction be on the relief side? Like, are we talking about a trade potentially? What kind of correction do you have in mind when you say that?
Yeah. No, that's you're asking the right. I don't know. I mean, I guess they have done it with Spencer Miles, is that you do just have to go to some of these guys.
Yeah.
You do just have to kind of find out more of what you have. Now, granted, some of these options have, I know guys like Yariel have been in a weird spot, but, you know, maybe you would try him in more of these spots. Adam Macko, I know he just came up, had his debut. So,
yeah, I mean, so is Macko, so is Yariel. Like, those guys are in big leverage. And the thing is, the Blue Jays aren't scoring, and this is putting them in a lot of high leverage spots. Like, This is the other byproduct of not having Kirk or Barger, Springer slow start, Vladdy chasing. Like, the offense isn't there, so they're not scoring runs. They don't have a particularly good offense right now. Haven't had one all season. Like, in a good game, yeah, they can put things together, but by and large, they're chasing, they're over-aggressive, they're expanding in ways that they didn't in 2025. So they're playing these, like, 4-3 games. Every inning of it is leverage. And so, yeah, they're turning to Yariel Rodriguez and Fluharty and Fisher and of course, Jeff Hoffman in leverage. Partly because they can't build themselves a huge lead.
Yeah. Yeah. And Jeff Hoffman, I just wanted to make sure I reiterated how weird his season has been. 858 OPS allowed this season, which is obviously awful for a high leverage reliever. 37% strikeout rate. So, which is by far a career high. One of the stranger small sample relief seasons we've seen in quite some time. But I know Jays fans don't particularly care about his FIP right now. But Ben, you just mentioned the other big thing that we have to make sure we hit before we say goodbye to Shai here, which is that they're not scoring. What the heck? The Blue Jays have all these cool, talented, famous hitters that we got to know and love, whether it is a Barger. I know he's been injured. Ernie Clement has been a big part of this. Of course, Vlad Jr. And you bring in Okamoto, who has been kind of what you hoped. But I think the fact that this maybe sums up the strange state of the Blue Jays offense. Okamoto leads the team with 12 home runs. Great. Oh, that's great news. That's double anybody else on the roster. Oh, okay. That's not a good sign. So, Shai, I'll throw it to you for the offensive check-in here. Is it just that Vlad has three homers? Is it just that they're really injured? What has stopped this offense from being a little bit more consistent and threatening the way that they were for a lot of last season?
Everything that you just said, it ties into that. And, you know, this recent stretch, and off the top of my head, it's either four or five wins in the past week and a half. They've scored two runs in them, which is not a very sustainable model, and is why you're seeing some of the heavy bullpen usage that has been necessary, and so many different guys having been thrown into leverage because they're constantly playing in it. And I think one of the big things that the Blue Jays have lacked this year is the slug that they've had, particularly slug with runners in scoring position. And they haven't been great with runners in scoring position regardless, but they got to slug. And in a lot of ways, these first 2 months are a bit reminiscent of the first 2 months last year, where the Blue Jays seem to be playing constantly a different version of the same game, where it's super tight. There aren't a lot of runs out there. They have some opportunities to score. They don't necessarily push them across. The big hit doesn't come, and everyone's just kind of like frustrated by it. And they started doing that towards the end of May into June last year. More of that slug arrived. And I think that's what the Blue Jays are waiting for now. We saw it in spurts a little bit in the last week at times, but it hasn't been there as consistently. And the Blue Jays are hoping that Barger can give them some of that when he gets back. They're hoping that Vladdy will obviously get back to it. And typically, as the weather warms up, so does he. And that's been the career pattern to this point. The Blue Jays are certainly hoping that repeats itself. And as much as they've missed Alejandro Kirk behind the plate, I think what they've missed is just the type of at bat that he gives in the middle of that lineup, because he just wears down pitchers. There's no real way to approach them. He forces them to get out of rhythm. And in talking to a National League pitcher earlier this year, he was just kind of saying how much he dreaded that at bat and how it would force him to think about it both before and afterwards. And it's not typical. You'd obviously think Vladdy's the guy the opposition pitcher is going to be worried about. But he was saying that he thought for him, Kirk was the toughest at bat in that lineup. And so just getting that back will help change the offense too. And maybe that leads to more of the mistakes. You know, Nathan Lucas's absence, he's another guy who just wears down pitchers and fouls off a lot of pitches. It's a really pain in the ass at bat. And getting him back too, he's a bit of a catalyst for this team. I think all those elements help wear down a pitcher and maybe lead to the mistakes that the Blue Jays did so well in capitalizing on last year.
Yeah, I think those are some great points. And I think that, you know, the correct, most full answer is that all these things are contributing to an environment where you're exposing other guys more, whether that's a lot of ABs for a Lenin Sosa, you're asking more of Tyler Heineman, you're asking more, you know, from so many of these different players that you ideally probably wouldn't be doing. Then you throw in the fact that, okay, Vlad Guerrero Jr., and this is where, like, I think fans would understandably gravitate in this direction, you know, at this point in the season, as we sit here in June, and Vlad Jr. has 3 home runs, right? So he's on pace for 8 home runs in the course of a full season. And I think for anyone familiar with Vlad Guerrero Jr. and what he can do, the idea that he would be healthy and on pace for 8 home runs in June is like a shocking thing. And he's clearly capable of more. He knows he's capable of more. We've seen this for a month now where he continues to expand. The quality of at-bat has not been good for Vlad Guerrero Jr. this season. Then you match that with George Springer, who's been playing on a broken toe and just hasn't looked like himself for, there's been a week or, you know, stretches of maybe a week or 10 days where he looks like himself. But by and large, he hasn't looked like himself either. Minus Bo Bichette, minus Barger, minus Kirk, this offense looks totally different and, unfortunately for the Blue Jays, a lot worse than the offense that we saw throughout the 2025 playoffs.
Yeah, and Vlad, I mean, it's worth noting that he did only hit 23 homers last year, which before he went nuclear in the postseason was also considered a relative down, you know, lower than what I think we expected from a slugging output standpoint. But Vlad's, you know, still got a .392 on base, which is pretty amazing to how what you're saying, which I agree with you. I watch him and I'm just like, wow, he doesn't look very good. And, you know, .390 on base speaks to,
I know
what you, and part of why this is what I talk about with Soto, like these guys' floors are just so much higher than everybody else in the, from an offensive competence, but you need more right now. You need more slugging. And that's just now what they're getting from him.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to be a hater on Vlad Jr. because end of the day, yeah, .390 on base, that's hard to find, but he's clearly capable of more and he is chasing a lot. I mean, demonstrably, objectively, yeah, he is chasing a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's totally fair. So Shai, I think to wrap this up, I think you mentioned there, oh, it's kind of reminiscent of last year where, hey, it was the first few months. It was kind of sluggish. We didn't really feel super inspired. This is right around when they really started to heat up. Maybe it was a little bit later, but through 60 games last year, their record was actually only slightly better, I believe. Last year, they were 31-29. They weren't in a postseason spot the way they are now. The AL looked a lot more daunting a year ago the way that it does now. So, you know, maybe the Yankees and Rays are going to separate themselves and the dream of defending the division title is not particularly realistic considering the situation. But I think a postseason spot is absolutely still within reach. My question to you, Shai, is I mean, do they have, this is where the depth also becomes relevant. I mean, how aggressive are we going to see them be come deadline time when you might not really have the pieces to trade? I mean, this is not, they've had some interesting developments on the farm, which we don't have to get into right now. So maybe they could flip some of those guys. How much are we going to see the Blue Jays act the way that they have for the last year, so the offseason, which is we view ourselves as clearly World Series contenders? How is that going to manifest as the deadline comes? And is it going to require them to actually, you know, be a few games over 500, or are they going to be more conservative in that respect?
I think it'll totally look at or totally depend on what the projection is, right? Like, are they on track to be someone that has a shot? And as long as they have a pretty good chance, and which I expect that they will based on the way that the American League is playing out, then I think we'll see them behave as they have in past trade deadlines, where they're looking to find pieces that add to the group and address holes. And they do have some assets that they can work with on the farm, right? And they may not necessarily, I think if they wanted to take a run at Tarek Skubal, they have some pieces that would be interesting to the Tigers, but I don't know that they would necessarily maybe match up with some other farm systems just yet. But they were, for the past few years, a bottom third, based on third-party ranking, farm system in the majors, and they were still able to be very productive at the trade deadline. And they are now middle of the pack in baseball from a farm system ranking perspective. So they have assets they can work with. They definitely have a surplus in the outfield. And I think that's something that other teams have been, at least been looking at this point with the Blue Jays. So they do have assets that they can work with. All these things are totally eye of the beholder, dependent on what clubs are selling. And we're still way too early kind of determine definitively what that's going to be, although some teams are clearly going to be selling already at this point, but that's only a small handful. But I think we'll see them behave as they've behaved in previous deadlines, where, you know, they're looking at trying to address the offense, trying to address the pitching staff, and seeing if they can do something for a bit of the longer term, as Ben pointed out in a great piece last summer.
Well, that's the thing, is they do go for it. They, you know, you look at it historically, as long as they've been at 500 or above, they always add pitching, they always add a bench bat. So I would anticipate that as long as they're 500 or above, they'll try to add a bench bat. They'll definitely add pitching. You look at, they've actually added some pretty big names, whether it's Jose Berríos or Jordan Hicks at the time. Of course, last year was Shane Bieber. They've gone after it. So despite not having those top prospects, they've found ways to add some pretty good players. And I think for all the talk at the trade deadline, usually if you're looking to add to your bullpen and bench, you can do that without having top prospects. So they'll at minimum find ways to do that.
Yeah, and you should also, you got to give them credit. We always talk so much about the high profile rentals, but hey man, they got Louis Varland last year, you know, and Kendry Rojas is looking like he could be something interesting. And you guys know how much I love Alan Rodon, but goodness, I mean, where would the team be without Louis Varland? That was true last postseason as well. But to acquire relievers in particular with multiple years of control, sometimes that can really work out nicely. Chai Davidi, thank you so much for joining us with some real Blue Jays insight. Ben, you know, I think the listeners could tell he was doing his best to keep up, but that's been true in the Blue Jays press box for years. So, Shai, where can people find your work before we kick you out and I ask Ben about the Diamondbacks?
All right. Sportsnet.ca is where you can find my and Ben's fine work. Shots fired at my colleague, at it, but he does obviously a great job, and I'm trying to keep up with him just as much. So we're at sportsnet.ca, at Twitter, at Shai Davidi, for myself as well. Or X,
thank you,
whatever
Shai.
We're calling it now.
No, we're still calling it Twitter. Don't worry. Thank you, Shai. Thank you, Ben. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbie. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Thanks again to Shai Davidi, but he's out of here, which means it's time to talk about the rest of the league. Let's go around it. In addition to the White Sox and Mets triumphs, we had three other sweeps over the weekend: the Mariners over the Diamondbacks, the Pirates over the Twins, and the Rangers over the Royals. But we are going to zoom in on Seattle and Pittsburgh for just to kind of a little thematic conversation here about pitching staffs and how you deploy them. We just had a conversation with Shai about the state of the Blue Jays' depleted pitching staff and how we're really just button mashing at this point to get through each and every day and how you're going to cover nine innings. Meanwhile, there are some pitching staffs in baseball that are overflowing with starting pitchers who seemingly belong and deserve in a rotation. They are healthy, they are throwing well, and so because the nature of Major League Baseball is that you have a five-man rotation instead of a six-man rotation, every once in a while you have a situation where a team has more good starters than they know what to do with. And in the case of Seattle and Pittsburgh, we have two organizations dealing with this problem in very different ways, and it is so far manifesting in very different ways. So let's start with Seattle. The Seattle Mariners, known for their pitching staff for the last few seasons, have had a very interesting development this season, which is that Emerson Hancock, former first-round pick, has emerged as a very, very good starting pitcher. Now, because of that, in tandem with the other homegrown guys that have been there and are established, like Logan Gilbert and George Kirby and Brian Wu, you also then have Bryce Miller and Luis Castillo. Luis Castillo, who was really struggling to start the season, Bryce Miller, who was injured to start the season. And because Emerson Hancock was throwing so well, they did not want to say, Emerson Hancock, sorry, back to the bullpen with you, back to Tacoma with you. When Bryce Miller got back from injury, you had six starters for five spots. They did not want to go to a six-man rotation. And so the Mariners decided, you know what? We are going to do a classic modern baseball strategy known as the piggyback. I don't know the first time that this phrase was used in this baseball context. However, it has become very common nowadays. And that is where you have two starters essentially pitching on the same day. But the Mariners have taken this to an extreme. This is not a situation where it's like opener and then bulk guy. Sometimes you hear that piggyback. Or we'll have two starters and they'll cover, you know, five or six or seven innings. And however the inning, you know, pitch count works out, it works out. The Mariners seem committed to this to a degree that we really have not seen, in that now multiple times they have essentially gone to Luis Castillo and Bryce Miller and said, the whole game is yours. They have alternated starting, but this was most relevant on Sunday, where they combined to throw 10 innings in a walk-off victory over the Diamondbacks to sweep Arizona. Before we get to what's going on in Pittsburgh, what do you make of the Luis Castillo, Bryce Miller, Emerson Hancock conundrum?
So I think this gets to kind of the heart of it, but from the outside, I think it's actually kind of cool. And you look at, you know, the first time where Castillo started and then Miller finished the last four innings, hey, that worked really well. Then they flip it this time, Miller's starting, now Castillo's finishing. It saves the bullpen. You're getting good production out of these pitchers. They stay stretched out, so when someone else inevitably goes down, they are not building back up from 25 or 30 pitches. They have a strong baseline to work from. So outside looking in from a very great distance, it makes sense. Now, of course, once you get closer, pitchers are creatures of habit. They very rarely like this, and this is where the discussion's going. So, you know, it's a tough thing to do. Now, I do think the way Bryce Miller's pitching, you cannot take him out of this role. He has to be a big part of the Mariners pitching staff. He's just too good not to be. What that means for Luis Castillo, TBD. And ideally, you keep him stretched out in some capacity. But to me, it always starts with the guys who are performing best. And right now, Miller is one of their five best pitchers.
Yeah, and Castillo, it's just tough because I had so little experience ever coming out of the bullpen at all. And we've seen very direct frustration with both of these guys, even as they have pitched well in these situations so far. It seems like the organization and the players are on the same page now. There's also going to be a bit of a cop-out for the next few weeks, because it seems like with the schedule, they are going to go to a six-man rotation, so those guys will probably get their own start days. But if all these guys stay healthy and keep pitching well, they're going to keep having to maneuver this in some form. However, of course, you'd still rather have more good pitchers than not. So this is a good problem to have, I think. But it is something to literally manage, and something for this front office to make sure that they can prove that they are all on the same page, because it seemed like they were not when this began.
Right. And then there's the Cade Anderson factor, which when I look at like in-season projections for starting pitchers rest of season, which is something that I'll do periodically, I see Cade Anderson's name up there at the very top of like what Oopsie and Steamer think that he could do. And then you look at what he's doing at Double A Arkansas. It's like he struck out 9 and didn't allow any hits on Friday. Like, this guy might be ready for the major leagues. And in other circumstances, we might be like on Cade Anderson watch, except for the Mariners are 6 deep as it is already.
It does feel like, sorry to just bring it back to Toronto, Cade Anderson would be one of their 5 best pitchers right now. I mean, like,
he'd be one of the 3 best starters right now.
right. And obviously the team that zoomed Trey Savage through the minors would happily be pitching Cade Anderson right now if he was with them. But yeah, I mean, he was the 3rd overall pick last year, and he's too good for Double A, but I almost feel like they're keeping him down there because once he's in Triple A, then everyone's just going to be asking the question every time he goes out there. So at the same time, I feel like sending him to Triple A and having him experience some like PCL nightmares might be good to like slow the hype down and just, it sounds stupid to say like humble him because again, he's not doing anything wrong, but whatever. You'd still rather have more good pitchers than you need to know what to do with. This is a strange situation, which brings us to Pittsburgh. Because Pittsburgh has another interesting rotation dynamic. You have Paul Skenes. You have Mitch Keller. You have Braxton Ashcraft, who, surprise, surprise, folks, is ahead of Paul Skenes on the current F4 leaderboard. He is top 10 in the National League in F4. He's been fantastic. So you have those 3 guys. And then you have Bubba Chandler. You have Carmen Majinski. And you have Jared Jones. Jared Jones just got back from Tommy John, made his first start of the season on Friday. The whole point is that, okay, Jared Jones is back. He gets to get his rotation spot back. Of course he does. Look what he did before he got sent down, or before he got injured. He belongs in the rotation. Well, Carmen Majinski is the odd man out here. They decided, hey, Carmen Majinski, you're going to the bullpen, despite the fact that his service numbers are way better than Bubba Chandler. Both of those guys have struggled in some respects, succeeded in others. The organization decided, sorry, Carmen Majinski, you're going to the bullpen. Carmen Majinski was like, I'm not loving that idea. I need to talk to my people. I need to figure this out. On Sunday, he was placed on the restricted list because he told the team he was not ready to pitch. That has certainly alienated him from many Pirates fans. As to his standing in the Pirates clubhouse, that remains to be seen. The Pirates said they still expect him to pitch on this upcoming road trip out of the bullpen. But it just goes to show that these pitchers with their roles, and certainly if you look at some of how the other guys are performing, I think in the Mariners' case, they're not going to look at Emerson Hancock and be like, screw that guy, because they know how well he's pitching. In the Pirates' case, you can understand Majinski looking at Bubba Chandler's struggles and being like, why am I the guy getting sent to the bullpen? This is another weird one, especially with younger pitchers who are less proven. It's not a situation where, like with Luis Castillo, you can say, well, you can understand that this guy's made $100 million. He started 200 games. He's all these things. I think Carmen Majinski is, while I do agree he has pitched better than Bubba Chandler this season, I'm not surprised that this is the direction Pittsburgh went, and it's kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I mean, credit to the Pirates for having this much pitching. And clearly, like when you have Jared Jones, and I know he answered some questions about, hey, what's the role going to be? He clearly wanted to start. And when you have Jared Jones throwing 100 in the minor leagues, and given what he did in his one healthy major league season, like, yeah, he's going to be a part of that rotation going forward. So to your point, yeah, this is not Luis Castillo. This is someone with a lot less MLB experience and pedigree. We're talking about Carmen Majinski. Now, there is an old school part of me that says, you know what? Just do your job, be quiet, go to the bullpen, figure it out. I have to admit, there's mm-hmm. a part of me that like wants to yeah, say that right here. Sure. And I'm sure there are baseball people that you know would believe that really strongly. And fair enough, like, you know, you haven't earned that much credibility yet. But at the same time, I do kind of applaud the Pirates in this situation for saying, hey, you're telling us you're not ready to pitch. Okay, you're going on the restricted list. That is your alternative. Your alternative is not that you can bully us into making the decision that you want us to. Your alternative is you're watching from the sidelines. We're calling up someone who is going to help us win today's game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's totally valid. And obviously, this was still, for both of these teams, a successful weekend. You know, the Pirates, kind of a wild weekend. It's crazy comebacks and narrow victories. But Pirates trying to get back on you know, NL Central is not waiting around for you, which is a good transition to our next topic. But I do think that the Pirates are, being around them a little bit last week, like, their conflict group vibes are, they're weird because they haven't gotten hot enough to where people are like talking about the Pirates, but they also haven't fallen into a skid to where we're like, oh, haha, Pirates, they suck. So it's a little bit of a kind of goes both ways. That said, the NL Central is not going to wait around for them. And that is because the St. Louis Cardinals continue to play good baseball. They took 2 out of 3 over the Chicago Cubs this weekend. However, I wanted to lean into another just pitching topic here, because we talk about teams like Pittsburgh and Seattle who have all these starters and they know what to do with. The Chicago Cubs right now are in the opposite situation. Jed Hoyer was very open speaking in Pittsburgh last week at the end of their losing streak. He said, listen, candidly, we thought, you know, our pitching depth is being pushed to its limits. We thought we had 10, 11 deep, and do not right now. And so I think now we're finding out what they can do, because I'm not worried about their lineup kind of coming out of their recent funk. But at some point, you're going to have to do better than what Jordan Wicks is giving them. Frankly, Taillon is probably going to have to be a little bit more stable than he has been. Ben Brown has been a huge bright spot. He was impressive again over the weekend. But Wicks continuing to struggle. They'll get Matt Boyd back at some point. They'll get Edward Cabrera back at some point. But Justin Steele is not coming back anytime soon, from what I can understand. He had a setback in his comeback from Tommy John. We know Cade Horton's out for the year. This is the team. I keep saying it. This is the team that needs to go out, be aggressive, trade for some pitching. And unlike with the Tarek Skubal situation where you can wait it out as long as possible, the Cubs, I just don't know how long they can wait. I just don't know how long they can wait before they just need to add something from externally, because even compared to Toronto, their AAA depth is brutal. They just don't have anybody that they can turn to right now. And I think that we're seeing that's starting to catch up to them, because I still think that they're a good team. I think that they're going to be in the mix here in the postseason race, but got to add some more arms, I think.
And maybe it costs more, but you have to just go out and do it. I mean, there's not a ton of pitching out there. You always hear that this time of year. And so to get anyone to jump the market for anyone, usually that means overpaying, but maybe there's a case for the Cubs to do that.
Yeah. Cubs are a team that I am struggling with what to do with my power rankings that will be coming out on Tuesday. The Cubs, the last time I did power rankings, I believe on like May 12th during one of their heaters, they were up at number 3, right behind the Braves and the Dodgers. They will not be number 3 this week, but they are still, you know, a few games over 500, and I still like the bones of the team, so I still expect them to be somewhere in the top half. But one team that this weekend, once again, told me, don't think about moving them down at all. That's the New York Yankees. They took 2 out of 3 in Sacramento. Their loss was not pretty and was certainly one that I'm sure they would like back because of how Aaron Boone managed it, and he said as much. But they respond on Sunday with a 13-run inning, which you don't see that every day, folks, and you certainly don't see that without any home runs. But I know you, Ben, as an observer of the league, think the Yankees are maybe almost perpetually underrated, at least during the regular season. So what do you see from them, certainly as a team that the Jays right now are not really competing with because they're so far behind them, but at the same time, this is a relevant team in the Jays' season. So I know you think about the Yankees a good amount.
Yeah, maybe too much. The Yankees are really good. I feel like the Yankees are underrated. They're so good. And I think that with the Rays obviously having the start to the season that they've had, that maybe allows people to bypass the Yankees a little bit and talk about, oh my goodness, you know, Drew Rasmussen, and this is so exciting. And it is, like, the Rays are good. That's, you know, no shade to Tampa. But the Yankees, like, it, you know, to have Rodon and Cole come back, which anytime you have injured pitchers trying to make their way back, there's a little bit of an unknown, but they both come back. Cole looks great. Then you add in the fact that Weathers has taken this step forward after being somewhat of a question in spring training, like a weird spring for him. Warren looks great. Schlittler with a huge step forward this season. I just love their starting pitching depth. The lineup is obviously good. Even with Aaron Judge having a down year by his standards, I think the OPS is down to about 911. But I mean, it's still 911 OPS. You have Rice obviously going off. Jose Caballero just filling in the gaps. Volpe comes back. He's looking great. So, you know, this team, it's not perfect. Like, I don't like their late inning relief. I think that they need to go out and be very aggressive at the deadline when it comes to adding late inning relief to help Cruz and Bednar back there, maybe with 2 relievers and maybe some bench bats. But hey, we're talking about bench bats and relievers. That's the best case scenario for being a deadline buyer. So to me, when I'm looking at the Yankees in Major League Baseball, maybe Atlanta, I guess the Dodgers, I guess, can be ahead of the Yankees. But to me, I mean, I think this is the best team in the American League.
Yeah, and I think that's what most of us thought early on in the season. And even with Tampa's surge, I think they still have a strong case as being as much. I guess right now the Yankees are only a game and a half behind Tampa. So they've, and their run differential is light years better. So no surprise there. The one thing I'll say about Judge is, yeah, OPS all the way down to 907 now. So, I mean, just the notion that Judge's OPS could start with an 8 at some point this week is pretty scary. That said, on one hand, like I've said about Otani, like I've said about Soto, whatever, when you're one of the best in the world, that's the standard I'm going to hold you to. So I don't feel bad being like you've been disappointing when you are OPSing 907. However, in the grand scheme of how good are the Yankees, this is still an amazing hitter that is certainly, one, capable of getting back to his otherworldly standards, and two, even at this level of production, you are loving having that at the top of your lineup and is a part of the reason why they are so good.
Absolutely. I mean, you look at just the depth of this lineup and they can shuffle things different ways. Like, saw Goldschmidt starting against a righty on the weekend. Of course, the Rice breakout. And this is without Austin Wells even really having anything going offensively. You have to think there's more for him offensively. You have to think there's more for Jazz offensively. So this is where I'm so, you know, I believe in the Yankees, is it's not like everyone's performing at the peak of their abilities even. Like, you would think Bednar, Cruz, Jazz, Wells, and obviously Volpe wasn't playing for much of the season until he came up and started playing really well. But that's a group that you could actually project for more than what they've given to this point in the year.
Totally agree. However, I will say about Judge, 10th in the American League in F-War and 7th in WRC+. I just bring that up because Otani's going to win MVP again. Can we all, we know that's happening again. But Judge, he's got some work to do. He's got some work to do. Now, if the Yankees, if he just has an awesome season and the Yankees are like far and away the best team in the American League, he doesn't have to be historic to win it again. But as long as Ben Rice's OPS is higher and as long as Yordan Alvarez and Bobby Witt Jr. are doing what they're doing, this is not going to be just auto Judge. And I do think that in the MVP discussion, that is an interesting second half storyline, no matter how far ahead the Yankees are in a playoff race.
Who is the favorite to win American League MVP right now? Like, is this the Jose Ramirez year? Like, who?
No. I mean, I wish it was, because I'd love to see that up close. It's not, because he'd have to get crazy hot for that to happen. Okay. Bobby Witt Jr. currently has a 0.7 yep. F4 lead over best player. but the Royals are terrible. They just got swept by the Rangers. And I think it's Yordan. Not that the Astros are any good. Weird times. Folks, yeah. in the American League MVP race. Maybe we'll have to explore that on a future episode. But Ben, I've taken up enough of your time. This has been a delight. We've gone way over. You and your cat have given us just an incredible, for those watching on YouTube, what a treat Ben has given us. So I know there's plenty more baseball that we could cover, but it's, you know, we'll do it on Wednesday. I got another special guest host coming on Wednesday. So if you're a Dodgers fan or a Rangers fan or Brewers, Rays, Braves, Red Sox, Rockies, you said we won series over the weekend, why aren't Jordan and Ben talking about us? Sorry, not sorry. Ben Nicholson-Smith, final words, what you got before we say goodbye?
You know what? Always a pleasure, Jordan. And let's talk soon.
Oh, you know we will. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and TJ Brassel for producing. Thank you to Shai Davidi for joining us earlier. Thank you to Ben Nicholson-Smith for pinch potting. Brilliant, as always. And we will talk to you on Wednesday. See ya.